seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 040194, Barker and others versus Heckman and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Brett Busby will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In this case, the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's ruling on limitations, reducing Heckman's damages from $111,000 to $16,000 as a matter of law because most of his claims for breach of contract were time-barred. But it conducted no review whatsoever of how this 86% drop in the results obtained affected the jury's award of $244,000 in attorney's fees. The Court's failure to analyze that question requires reversal here. We submit there are two possible tools that a court could use to analyze the impact of a substantial change in damages on a fee award, either a harm analysis or a factual sufficiency review. With respect to harm, the Court of Appeals could have examined the scope of the harm from the limitations error it had just reversed, asking whether that error probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment on fees as well as damages. In this case, it did. By substantially altering Heckman's damages, the limitations error also infected one of the important factors the jury was instructed to consider in setting the attorney's fees, the amount involved and the results obtained. Recognizing this link between the amount of damages and the fee calculation, both state and federal courts have held that the proper remedy when damages change substantially on appeal includes a remand for a new trial on fees. Yet the Court of Appeals didn't address the Barker's request for a new trial on fees at all. Second, the Court of Appeals could have used the factors in the charge to conduct a meaningful factual sufficiency review of whether $244,000 is still a reasonable attorney's fee given the changed results obtained. A detailed review of the evidence in light of these factors is essential because, as this court has said, the factors are the only meaningful way to determine if fees are in fact reasonable and not excessive.
Yes, sir. During the testimony, the expert testimony on attorney's fees, was there any attempt to limit or discussion about whether some of the cause of action may have been time barred and some not, whether the fee should apply? Was there any discussion about that?
The only questions that were asked were whether $244,000 would be a reasonable fee because the damages were approximately half of that. So there was testimony that a 2-to-1 ratio would be reasonable. There was no question asked, nor was there an answer given that a 15-to-1 ratio would be reasonable. We submit that it's
so it's reasonable for the lawyer to get twice as much as the client, but not 15 times as much.
Well, in this case, we believe in this case, there's no evidence that it would be in this particular record.
The other factors except the results obtained would stay the same.
Well, there was really only testimony on the lodestar and the results obtained in this case. There was the lodestar being the amount of hours spent times the reasonable hourly rate, which is the first two factors, and on the results obtained. There isn't really testimony either way on the other of the seven factors. So really you only have testimony on the lodestar and the results obtained, and the question is, if the results obtained change dramatically, what happens? As the Court of Appeals said, there's sufficient evidence on the ratio on the lodestar to support that, or do you have to take into account that the jury was also instructed to consider the results obtained and that they could have come to a different conclusion other than awarding the full amount of the lodestar?
Let me ask you a question that kind of follow up on Justice Green's. Is it possible in a Castile or Harris County way for a defendant who is resisting attorney's fees and thinks that there are some liability findings for which there is no evidence to segregate in the court's charge the question on fees? How much fees go to this breach of contract issue for which we think there's no evidence? How much on this one to preserve that error for the Court of Appeals to make a determination?
Well, we think not. The Court of Appeals said that what we should have done is objected to the failure to the award of attorney's fees globally, and that we should have segregated, asked the court to segregate Heckman's fees for various services. I'm not sure what they mean by services, but we would say that no, it's not required, and it's not really feasible to have a charge that would say, if the trial court is wrong in its legal ruling on limitations, and the results obtained are only $16,000, not $111,000, sort of counterfactually if you disagree basically with the legal ruling that the trial court's made, what would the result, what would you find the reasonable attorney's fees would be? And then you would have similar sort of hypothetical questions during, presumably during the attorney's fees exchange on the expert testimony, where you would say, you know, is this, if the results are obtained or this, what's the reasonable fee? And that sort of thing. I would submit that that actually unduly emphasizes the result obtained. If you have several questions saying, you know, if you ask the expert, if this is the results obtained, what's the reasonable fee? And if you have a question in the charge that says, if this is the results obtained, what's the reasonable fee? If this is the results, what's the reasonable fee? So we don't think including hypothetical questions like that in the charge and the testimony would be helpful. In fact, it would be confusing to the jury, and we would submit that it's contrary to the policy of trying to simplify the charge. In addition, there are several cases that are cited in our brief and in the amicus brief that say when the damages change substantially on appeal, that is harmful to the calculation of attorney's fees, and therefore the proper remedy is to remand for a new trial. In none of those cases did the court say you don't get a remand because you didn't ask the court at the charge conference to break out what the reasonable fees would have been had the results obtained been different. And what, so,
of course, that's going to be a lot of retries. I mean, what percentage of the time in DTPA and contract cases does the trial judge or an appellate court cut back the actual damages? I bet it's 30% of the time, maybe more.
Well, I actually don't know how often that happens.
It'd be hundreds of cases.
Well, the one reason it's important to have a substantial change standard for the harm is that it allows you to say if the change is not very great in this circumstance, we're going to say that it doesn't cause harm. So it gives you flexibility.
But in all the ones where it is substantial, that's more than just a pittance, if it's changed or reduced by the trial judge or on appeal, we're going to have call in another jury, have another jury trial. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here for you to decide attorney's fees on a case tried 5 years ago.
Well, I think a lot of times
call
these
all
things
the lawyers back, run up some more fees another time to say, well, you know, the fees back then were this. They're going to want to know why we're doing this 5 years later.
Sure, I understand the concern. I think a lot of times people agree to try these things to the judge, so you're not going to be calling in another jury. And I really don't think that there are a lot of cases where you're going to have such a substantial change that you're going to have to send it back. But it seems to me that we did what we were required to do to preserve the argument. On the factual sufficiency issue, we made an objection in our new trial motion, which is how you preserve a factual sufficiency review of the reasonable amount of attorney's fees. On the limitations issue, we raised it repeatedly in our answer, in our summary judgment motion, in a JNOV, and that's how you preserve a challenge to limitations. And so it doesn't seem to me that you have to also preserve the remedy from the error you've just preserved. And to the extent that the complaint is that the change occurred on appeal, we complained about that timely, because the complaint that the fees have to be revised when the damage award is reduced substantially on appeal arose from the Court of Appeals judgment reducing that damage. And the Bunton case from this court recently said that it's proper to preserve that for the first time on appeal.
But you're not claiming, or are you, that there has to be proportionality? I mean, the attorney's fee statute is reasonable attorney's fees. So you can have cases with small damages but high attorney's fees.
Certainly.
Depending upon how recalcitrant a defendant might be in a case.
Certainly. I mean, one virtue of the proportionality rule that the amicus has proposed is at least it ties us to something that the jury found, where in this case the jury found a ratio of about 2.2 to 1 of damages to attorney's fees. And so at least we know what the jury thought the proper ratio was. And so at least if you start with that, you're tying it to something the jury did. But we certainly agree that can be adjusted based on the other testimony.
If we treat this like regular damages instead of punitive damages, because punitives are a little bit of a different animal. They're to punish and deter, and this is just to compensate. It seems like what we would do then is remand to the Court of Appeals to do a factual sufficiency review, just as they would with any other damage award. And they could look at the testimony in the trial court. Apparently there's some evidence in this case that it was a difficult case accounting-wise, and there's allegations and some testimony about hiding the ball a little bit and falsifying documents. But the Court of Appeals could review that and find the evidence is factually sufficient.
Well, it seems difficult for the Court of Appeals to conduct a factual sufficiency review based on evidence that the jury didn't hear, because the jury didn't know that the results obtained were only 16,000, not 111,000. And so the Court of Appeals would really be saying, you know, what's the maximum amount that the jury could have awarded had they known the results obtained that we know now? So it's a little bit more like finding rather than unfinding a fact, I would submit. But you know, if this court thinks that it's more proper to send it back to the Court of Appeals for them to conduct that review rather than sending it back to the trial court for the trier of fact to reset the fees in the first instance based on the correct results obtained, we would certainly acquiesce to that. But we do think that the way that the Court of Appeals conducted its factual sufficiency review was flawed because it didn't look at all at what the results obtained were. It said the results obtained are $111,000, not $16,000, as we've just presumed, as we've just held that they actually
are.
Well,
I mean, it's sort of a bait and switch on the jury because the jury is told to consider the results obtained that it's rendering the verdict on, and it would be reasonable. So you're sort of measuring what the jury did by a different standard in hindsight.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. I think there was nothing wrong with the particular charge in this case. If the district court had agreed with us on the limitations issue, the jury would have only been given the claims that would support the $16,000 in damages. If they kept out the barred claims, the jury would have only considered the timely claims in setting the damages. And I just don't see how it's practical to granulate the charge out and say, for example, if there'd been an issue on the discovery rule in this case and the jury had to make a finding on the discovery rule in order to decide whether it was timely, and they found that there was a discovery issue and that all of his claims were timely, you wouldn't then say in the attorney's fees question, well, assuming that you answered your discovery rule question the other way, what would the damages be? It seems that you shouldn't have to granulate a charge against the possibility of reversal on a legal issue or on a factual issue like that, where it's not just saying, you know, we want a separate, like in the Castile scenario, you're saying we want a separate answer for each one of these so we can review it. Here you're actually saying, assume it's contrary to what you've been told. So,
was there a little bit of tension in the charge and the eight factors? Because one of them is the amount of money involved and the results obtained. Another one is whether the fee is fixed or is contingent on results obtained.
Mm-hmm.
This was not contingent on results obtained. It was a lodestar.
That's correct. It was. And I think that's probably why they break it out like that and say that you need to consider the results obtained in addition to whether it's fixed or contingent. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that that's, in fact, the most important factor is the results obtained, and that even if you have a complaint that, that even if you have testimony that the lodestar is completely reasonable, in other words, that there's no segregation issue and that every hour that went into the lodestar calculation is on a valid claim or it's intertwined with a valid claim, and if every hour is on a claim that they actually succeeded on, you can still argue that that total amount is not reasonable given the results obtained. And in fact, federal courts reduce those awards routinely. They usually remand to the district court to do it rather than doing it on appeal. But they say you don't even have to look at the other factors, that the court has discretion alone based on the results obtained to reduce it. And just to point the court to those state and federal cases that follow the new trial standard, those are at page 4 of our reply, as well as the coal chemical case that we submitted, and at page 10 of the amicus brief.
Why is it we try attorney's fees to the jury and the feds do it to the judge?
There's a rule in federal court that allows them to do it to the judge. Here in Texas, it's been held that it's a fact question, and therefore, since all fact questions go to the jury, that's how it's ended up there. But the federal court has changed that rule.
Of course, it's costs, and costs could be a fact question, but judges in Texas always decide those.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's, you know, that would be one way to simplify the issue, but the current law is that it's tried to the jury.
That would be a big step.
Yes, sir. Now, on the issue of the new trial on fees, we submit that one of the areas this court should look at is Rule 61.2 in order to figure out what the proper harm analysis should be. And that rule asks whether only part of the matter in controversy is affected by an error and whether the other parts are separable without unfairness to the parties. In this case, we would say that the limitations error did not only infect the damages part of the controversy, and that fees are not separable without unfairness to the parties because you have the link between the two through the results obtained factor. Just would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Ketchin will present argument for the respondent.
I'd like to first begin by addressing the fee issue, even though we do not concede, as you're aware, of the limitations question. So I do want to reserve some time for that so I can talk about that. In this case, I do not believe, and I can see no reason, that the issue that they're talking about being reversed on appeal could not have been addressed at the trial court level. The facts in this case were that the parties had agreed to reserve to Judge Baker the question of statute of limitations to be done in a legal briefing subsequent to the trial. And so that question was clearly on the table, and that was going to be an issue was clearly known. And at no time, but we went forward and presented to the jury the questions of attorney's fees. And there would be nothing, it would seem to me, that would have prevented some discussion, some issue, some conditional request for findings, if that was what the...
What would that have said?
Pardon me?
What would that have said?
I would think that you could have asked the jury in the event that...
In the event that you, the jurors, are wrong and the trial judge is also wrong, what would you do if some court someday said something else? How many attorneys? I mean, how in the world would they answer that?
Well, I'm not sure you would phrase it quite like that.
But that's in effect what you're asking.
Well, I think so. But
you ask the juror what the damages are, and then you ask them, but if the damages were something else, what would a reasonable attorney fee be? And they're going to say, well, something else like what?
Well, I think that is the obligation of the defendant in this case to propose something if they want a finding on that particular issue. I mean, in this case, there were conditional findings. There was a finding in the event that there is a petition for review to the Supreme Court. What would it be? In the event that there is an appeal to the Supreme Court, what would it be? And there was testimony about that, and the jury found that, which were all subsequent events, that they didn't know whether that would happen or not. And so it would seem to me that it's entirely possible to frame a question like that in these particular circumstances where there's a legal issue in the case that's known.
That begs a question, as Judge Brisher said. What would that question be? The questions that are asked, what would the fees be on appeal? Those are standard questions, and those numbers are easily ascertainable through expert testimony. But when you have to segregate the fees in a case like this, I mean, what is the question? How do you ask that question without commenting to the jury that there's a chance that one side is going to lose, and if they lose, what would you do? Difficult.
It is perhaps difficult, but if you know that you're going to raise the question subsequently, that the limitations will bar this claim above a certain amount, I don't see any reason that says in the event that damages are found to be X, subsequently what is a reasonable attorney's fee in that?
Can you think of any reason why we shouldn't follow the federal courts in this area? It seems like the federal courts remand back to the courts of appeal. Well, they remand for a determination of remitter. And why shouldn't we follow that same approach?
Well, for one thing, there's a federal rule of civil procedure that the whole presumption is that attorney's fees will be heard after the trial by the court pursuant to a separate procedure unless it's part of the damages element in the case, which then gets into a question about that when you have to deal with it. But I would say that routinely it's a court function, whereas in Texas routinely it's not a court function. Furthermore, in this particular case.
But it's still based on evidence. I mean, it's just who's going to judge the evidence. I mean, that's a difference, I understand, but I don't. Still an evidentiary inquiry.
Well, if the belief was that this issue is so critical that we ought to do that, then to me that is a legislative or perhaps a rulemaking kind of function. I mean, I don't believe that it's appropriate for this court in this particular setting. I mean, one thing, factual sufficiency.
We bifurcate bad faith and breach of contract claims and insurance cases without a rule and without a statute.
The issue here of I'm not saying it can't be done. I am saying, however, that an issue such as which is being alleged against us of proportionality of how you calculate it, those are highly, highly rulemaking functions in Rule 42 with respect to class actions, and you know there was a procedural aspect to it. It would seem to me, since there's a legislative statute on attorney's fees, if the court is going to mandate some rule having to do with proportionality, that is a legislative function.
I guess your argument would work both ways. If the plaintiff proved as a matter of law damages that the trial court didn't find, the court of appeals said you did find that, and that proof increases damages by $10 million. Even in that instance, there wouldn't be a reassessment of the fees awarded. Is that right?
I don't believe so.
Even though that's one of the factors in Lodestar.
That's exactly right. I mean, just consider what is going on at this particular court, the Supreme Court. I mean, I received at the trial court level 5 years ago when I testified about it, $12,500 for appeal. In the meantime, that was not known to the jury. Mr. Barker is dead. Ms. Barker is in bankruptcy. Their business is in bankruptcy. The only reason we're here now is the federal bankruptcy court has said we should let this case proceed under a relief from stay to get a judgment to liquidate the thing, so that we can go back and make a claim.
Well, but that's that's the problem with a trial jury awarding appellate fees. You're predicting the future, and
right.
That's always going to be.
And that's, I guess, kind of my point is that what ought to be sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. I mean, if I had known what's going to happen, I would have asked for a whole lot more in appellate fees, to tell you the truth. And I certainly didn't guess that the 10th largest law firm in the United States would be pouring briefs on me in a case with very little economic value.
If I can get a word in edgewise.
Pardon me, Your Honor.
Part of the problem, part of what courts of appeals are to do, is to not have these McDonald's coffee cup verdicts where somebody gets millions of dollars for something that the public's going to be outraged about and throw all of us out of a job and send all of us to arbitration and close down the civil justice system. We've got a case here now where you say the jury said $120,000 in damages and $240,000 for the attorney. And then the Court of Appeals said, no, $15,000 for the client and still $240,000 for the attorney. That looks a little excessive. That looks like we're running this deal for you rather than your client, doesn't it?
Well,
I mean, your client's going to get $15,000. You're going to get $250,000. And then how much of your client's $15,000 is going to come out for expenses, too?
This is a case in which those are actual fees incurred. In fact, less than the actual fee.
I don't doubt that, but the question is that shouldn't somebody in the court system go, this is not a good way to run a railroad?
Well,
where the attorneys get everything and the clients get a thank you letter from the attorney, thanks for keeping me busy for the last year and a half.
Well, except that here the standard is factual sufficiency. It isn't automatic. If the court in this case examined the record, said they applied the factual sufficiency standard, they didn't write an opinion detailing the results, nor were they required to under existing law. And had they determined that it was the type of case you're talking about, there is a remedy. I mean, if in examining the whole record, the evidence is insufficient under the great weight and preponderance standard, so as to be manifestly unjust. So there is a protection in there against that runaway way out verdict. But
how many times on a $15,000 verdict, how big does your fee have to be before it's outrageous? A million? A billion?
I guess we could agree on a billion.
$15,000 case.
I guess we could agree. Well, except that, I mean, you know, this gets to the heart of real philosophy is, you know, we have to have a system where somebody calls the balls and the strikes and a free market system has to work with some, and there's at times the transaction costs are high. In this particular instance, I would say the transaction costs are high because of the defendants in this particular case. I mean, I've tried and settled a lot of accounting cases a lot cheaper than this, but we couldn't do it. Still can't do it. I mean, here we are at the Supreme Court on a case that's worth very little when you factor everything into it. And yet, what do we do? Do we give up?
Well, you can envision a scenario where a defendant sort of engages in Rambo tactics and runs attorney's fees up and then complains on appeal that somehow is disproportionate.
Well, I think that's the scenario we have here. I mean, we tried to summarize it, but you had failure to produce documents, producing the multiple documents of the same thing, producing, we think, fraudulently produced documents, long depositions. And it started out, the first demand, which is in the record, it's attached to one of your briefs, Exhibit 30, I mean, the attorney's fees requested were $200 to settle this case, and they didn't, accept it. And so here we are, years later. So there are just simply times that it is reasonable to give a person who's doing nothing more than vindicating his business rights. I mean, nobody said Dr. Ekman wasn't cheated. I mean, this whole record, nobody's disagreed with the fact that he was denied what his contract said he was going to get, and it cost him money, and so he used the court system to vindicate his
rights.
Well,
and I guess that can work both ways. Both parties can use the court system. So why shouldn't we send it back down to the Court of Appeals for a factual sufficiency review of the attorney's fee award and let the Court of Appeals decide if there should be a remittiture or not in light of, as you say, if there's abuse, then the Court of Appeals would not remit?
Well, except there was a factual. I mean, the Court of Appeals said we have done a factual sufficiency. So the issue would be.
But they did the factual sufficiency review looking at the $100,000+ as opposed to the $16,000. If we sent it back down and said review the sufficiency of the evidence in light of the $16,000 award, why couldn't we let them review that?
That gets to the very heart of what we're talking about. This court would have picked out one issue, the relationship of damages and attorney's fees, and said, we say that is the key thing. And presumably the court will have to give some guidance as to what that may be. You've picked that out of all of the circumstances of this case. Why should the Court of Appeals not look at the whole case? I mean, if I had to do it again, I would ask for more attorneys. I mean, just for being here. I mean, and having to face, these excellent lawyers who are just, pouring it on us. I mean, in a case worth very little. I mean,
Well, this case is, maybe unusual in that respect, but there are many cases of high dollar amounts in controversy where this issue is recurring, where there's a dramatic reduction of the damages on appeal, and there seems to be a disproportionality between damages and the fees that were originally found by the jury. So we're not simply looking at this case. We're looking at, is there something in our system that needs to be corrected so that, for example, courts of appeals can conduct the sort of review that you've suggested? Has the defendant overbilled this case? Have they engaged in sanctionable conduct, et cetera, which might make the fee justifiable here?
But I think the court is then adopting a rule that every case will have a second trial within the trial before we can get it over with.
It's just a factual sufficiency review by the Court of Appeals that takes into account that there has been a serious reduction on appeal, and therefore we're going to take another look at attorney's fees and may uphold them or may suggest remittance.
That would be, I believe, the policy thing that is wrong. Why just that factor? Because there could be all kind of reasons why this has happened. And to simply say that one factor, the relationship of damages to attorney's fees, we're going to consider that in a special way. First place, the Court of Appeals has already considered that issue. They said they have. I mean, they wrote their opinion that we've done a factual sufficiency review. And I think, and this court is not entitled to review that. You'd have to say, we're going to go back and make you do more on this one issue, and what is there about that one issue that calls out for that? And in fact, I think it's well, very dangerous because it...
By the same token, though, I mean, I hear you, but they've already done that. They've looked at that one element. They've just used, arguably, the wrong measure. So it would just be asking them to do what they did before, just with a different measure in there, a 16 instead of 111.
Well, you know, the court knew what had happened. I mean, I don't know how you know what they did was the wrong measure. I mean, they said it's a factual sufficiency review. We've looked at the whole record. There was no objection to this evidence. There was no issue on this evidence. There was no nothing on this evidence. And taken as a whole, this is satisfied. The standard already is that if it's unjust as a measure against the entirety of the record, they can reverse and sometimes do, as you've seen the cases cited. I mean, it's not that they're without a remedy. This court is being invited to and would be going beyond that to impose yet another layer of inquiry that I have a hard time seeing any policy, you know, supports that.
Well, Justice O'Neill raised the issue about punitive damages and perhaps your guidelines for that, and how is it any different? I mean, the United States Supreme Court has outlined guidelines in the Gore versus BMW case and Cooper versus Leatherman case as it pertains to punitive damages. Why couldn't those outline that a similar situation be done here for this type of situation that you have as it pertains to attorney's fees?
I presume anything, you know, can happen in the Supreme Court, but I mean, the question is whether it should. In punitive damages, what the court said at Morial is that it's inherently an unguided process, and you know there can be more. Here, it's a function of evidence and expert testimony, and you know what the jury has heard. They're not at large to the degree that they would be in a punitive damages case. I think there is a clear policy distinction, and I would urge that there would be a strong interest in achieving finality. I mean, if you leave open the question of attorney's fees, which is a part of the judgment, in an inordinate number of cases, it would seem to me whether you ever have a final judgment, it's just going on and on and on. I mean, it's already been 5 years in this case.
On your limitations question.
Thank you.
Are you arguing for a discovery rule on breach of contract cases? Looks like it.
Your Honor, the overwhelming law in the cases that we've cited are to the effect that in a bailment situation, the statute of limitations accrues when there is a demand at the end of the bailment.
But usually those are conversion cases.
Pardon?
Usually those are brought as conversion cases.
It may well be in a factual sense that is the case, but there are other cases that have said that where there are contractual issues associated with the bailment, the same rule applies. That's the case. That's what the law that we were relying on, but focusing on when my client made a demand to terminate the bailment and get his material back, everything was within a four-year...
But the cheating had already been done.
The cheating had already been done.
Bull Siemens sold, no accounting to you.
Exactly.
That had been done years before.
Right. It had been a long-term...
And so, in effect, your contract case is that discovery rule applies to breach of contract. It's not when the contract's breached. It's when you discover that the contract's breached.
It's not the discovery rule as it applies to contracts. I believe the rule in a bailment case is the statute of limitations begins to run when you make a demand for the return of your product and the bailment is over. We have cases that say that. Or you could, if in fact you had notice, I mean, then it could be the notice issue, which I believe is the defendant's burden to raise that issue in a bailment case. I mean, that is the question. The overwhelming case law, although I'll be the first to admit that this is one of these old doctrines that are laying around that, you know, hadn't been written on in a long time. But the overwhelming number of cases, including one in specifically, which is not reported in the Southwest Second out of the First Court of Appeals, just flat say that even if the issue is contractual, if it arises out of a bailment, if it's a contractual incident to the bailment, it accrues once the bailment terminates. And there's good policy for that. I mean, a bailment is somebody else has your property. They're controlling it. They deal with it. You don't know about it, and so when you terminate the bailment, if they've in fact cheated you, then limitations begins to accrue. By that standard, which I believe is the legal standard, everything we sought is within the statute of limitations. The Court of Appeals on that issue just simply wrote nothing, to tell you the truth. I mean, they were utterly silent, and that question had been fully briefed all the way through. So I think my time is up.
Thank you, Counsel.
I'd like to respond to one issue about how we know that the Court of Appeals applied the wrong number for the results obtained. And they do say in their opinion, we therefore review the factual sufficiency of the attorney's fees awarded by the jury in light of the jury's award of $111,000. So that's how we know that they did not apply the correct, legally correct results obtained. Now, my fear about a remand to the Court of Appeals in this case is that they're going to make the same argument that they've made to you here, which is that it's, the error is harmless, the change in the results obtained is harmless because there's enough evidence on the lodestar to support $244,000. Well, what that does is it exalts the lodestar as the only factor and completely ignores the results obtained. So you can't give no weight to the result obtained.
But they considered the result obtained. They may have considered the wrong result obtained, but they did consider that element, and it is one of the elements that the jury was instructed to consider.
Absolutely. And so I think you can't just say that this, that there's factually sufficient evidence to support this. I would urge this court to give guidance to the Court of Appeals on how to conduct this sort of review if you're going to send it back, because it's different than a factual sufficiency review of a single element of damages, because here you've got a multi-factor test.
Well, you would say that we must tell them that they have to remit some portion because of the ratio?
No, Your Honor. I just ask them to give serious consideration to the results obtained as well as the amount involved. I mean, one way to do it is, as the amicus suggests, to say that's the ratio that the jury said, so you need to give serious consideration to that. This court has said the same thing in the punitive damages context in your Southwestern Investment versus Neely case.
So you would agree that there could be cases in which the take this situation, it goes back to the Court of Appeals, if that's what we were to say, and the court could uphold that attorney's fee award by the jury, with the reduction.
We would say not on this evidence, because the only evidence that's in the record is that 2.2 times the damages is a reasonable attorney's fee.
But again, I mean, I think you acknowledged at the beginning that you're not urging a proportionality rule, because we're guided by reasonableness. And what the court would need to look at in terms of reasonableness is not so much a ratio as it is, were the fees justified in light of legal issues involved and the discovery issues that presented and the peculiarities of the particular case.
And also the results obtained, which just has to be, all I'm saying is that has to be given some weight. The U.S. Supreme Court says it's the most important factor. And so you cannot just say, well, there was a lot of discovery in this case, and so we had to spend a lot of time on things, and there was a lot of time on discovery, so an 86% change in the results obtained is not reviewable. That would be our position. Now, in terms of the punitive damages, I'm sorry, Justice Green.
Before you leave, I want to talk about the bailment questions.
Yes.
Limitations thing. Somebody puts a car in storage, long-term storage, bailment agreement, say 2-3 years or whatever, and to get the car back, come back to make a demand to get the car back, and it turns out that there's been some damage done to the paint, chemical leak or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Cause of action accrues when?
Well, I think it depends on what you sue for. But if you sue for example, negligence in that case because they didn't store the car properly,
that's gone because, say, 2 years before.
Well, I mean, I think you can say that they didn't return the car, and that you could also sue for breach of contract and say they didn't return the car in the same condition as when you gave it to them and they promised to take care of it and that sort of thing. So the breach actually occurs when they give it back to you in the faulty condition. In this particular case, when they demanded the return of their bull semen, we gave it back to them. There was no breach at that point. We gave them back more than they thought they should have gotten. The breach occurred when what they say is that we should have sold it years earlier and gotten money and remitted it to them
so
then.
So your argument is they never breached the bailment agreement?
No, the jury found that we breached the bailment agreement, and we're not here challenging that, but the breach occurred at the time that this transaction was supposed to take place, because unlike the car example, this was an agreement where they said, here's our product, sell it, not here's our product, store it, and give it back to us in the same condition as which you found it.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted and the court is going to take another.